Welcome to NeuroDialogues, the NeuroPodcast. I'm James Watt, and this is episode 4 of our long format program where we interview some of the most interesting names in the world of neurodiagnostics. This week, I interview Dr. Jack Cartouche as he sounds the alarm about persistent quality and safety issues in neuromonitoring and how it is employed in procedures placing the facial nerve and other cranial nerves at risk for injury. We co-produced this episode of the podcast to provide some extra visual information throughout the interview. Dr. Cartouche talks about his diverse interests, his life philosophy, and his foray into medicine and neuromonitoring. We spend a good deal of time discussing best practices in facial nerve monitoring and ongoing challenges. Dr. Cartouche emphasizes the critical importance of proper training for the surgical neurophysiologist, the reading neurologist, and the surgeon. He discusses the lack of acceptance of neuromonitoring in the early days and the importance of continuous improvement today. He discusses future challenges and opportunities in the field and sounds the alarm on persistent safety and quality issues with some neuromonitoring systems and products on the market today. We trust that you will find this episode of NeuroDialogues valuable and insight. We hope you enjoy the interview, and we thank Dr. Cartouche for taking his time to speak with us today. If you like what you hear, please subscribe on YouTube or wherever you listen to your audio podcasts. Well, Dr. Jack Cartouche, it's great to have you on the podcast today. I've known you for years, and I've known you professionally, gotten to chat with you a little bit personally as well. And I know we want to talk today about neuromonitoring, especially as it relates to facial nerve neuromonitoring. But it's great to have you. So thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to meet with us and talk to the community.
Good to appear, James, and good to see you after all these years.
Great to see you. So, yeah, I don't think there's a person in the neuromonitoring world that doesn't know who you are, Jack, but tell us, you know, a little bit about yourself, who you are professionally, who you are personally, and, you know, how you kind of got to where you are today in your career.
Thank you, James. Well, you know, I've recently done some general sort of podcasts, so I really sort of want to focus on some of the key things on neuromonitoring for this one, but short story is I was always interested in doing things differently. I submitted my first patent as a 9 or 10-year-old kid when my dad said my food was always cold. I saw orange wires in a toaster, and I said, why don't we put wires on a plate, and then my food won't get cold. So that was my first submission around 1960. We were ripped off, and a year and a half later, hot plates started coming out on the market. So that was my first lesson in intellectual property. Nice. Later in life, I saw the Beatles when I was young, and I just couldn't believe how cool they were, how the girls were screaming for them. So I got started playing guitar when I was little, got into a band, got offered a recording contract from Decca Records. And to do so, I had to learn how to play guitar. I had to learn how to write songs and lyrics. So early on in my life, I really got into doing these things. I really had, you know, no thought that I had these talents. But every time something came up, it was like, let's give it a try and see what happens.
Nice. Very nice.
And one of the big pictures I found in life is that if you're always just going for the big enchilada at the end, you may never get it, you may never be satisfied. But if you can find little pleasures, little hits of dopamine along the way, it'll keep you going. And that little hit of dopamine might be finding just the right lyrics for your new song. It might be finding just the right font for the PowerPoint. And as soon as I finish that PowerPoint slide, I go, yes. And that keeps me going. So it's good to be able to have that type of self-reinforcement that will keep you going. And the same was true academically. I had no desires to go into medicine, but when it looked like medicine was going to be easier than being a rock and roll star, I got into it. Someone suggested I author a paper. I had no interest in authorship, in research. I wrote my first paper. I got accepted, saw it in a journal. I go, okay.
So you got hooked.
Cool. Got hooked. And then after a few of these successes, as I got into med school, I would start making suggestions, and they weren't always well tolerated by the professors. And I've mentioned some of these things in my history in the past, so I won't belabor them. But as a third-year medical student, I watched a patient get intubated. The resident put the endotracheal tube in the wrong tube down the esophagus instead of the endotracheal tube. The patient almost died. I suggested to the chairman of anesthesia, why don't we measure oxygen and CO2? He said, we don't need gimmicks, so I did not pursue pulse oximetry, which 3 years later came out of Japan and changed the world of measuring oxygen and CO2.
It would be a medical malpractice now if you didn't measure oxygen and CO2.
Absolutely. And then the next thing, just to be very brief about it, is in 1977, I decided I'd like to do neurosurgery. At University of Michigan, I saw people who had acoustic tumors who often woke up with a paralyzed face. I saw ENT patients with parotidectomies who woke up with a paralyzed face. I said, there's got to be a better way. So in 1977, I decided to leave Michigan and study neurosurgery in Stockholm, Sweden, at the best program in the world in neurology and neurosurgery. So that's how I got started. I learned how to do needle EMG by Professor Kugelberg, one of the top people in the universe.
Okay.
And then after that, I went on to the neurosurgery rotations. But on a napkin, I wrote down my idea for a little EMG box that was connected to stimulators that would allow you to do monitoring during surgery. The neurologist thought it was great. The neurosurgeon said the same thing that the anesthesiologist told me the year before. Jack, we don't need gimmicks. So I flew back to America, tried to convince University of Michigan Neurosurgery and Otolaryngology about my idea. They didn't accept it. Tried to convince University of Michigan attorneys. They didn't think there was a market for it. So anyhow, doing the quick story, I eventually went to a little company in Madison, Wisconsin called Nicolet. And I made a connection with them because I was one of the first in America to start doing facial electroneurography, ENOG, to test how bad a Bell's palsy was. So I'd had a connection. And I said, here's my idea for making a nerve monitor. They thought it was a good idea. I had the impression wrongly that being a Michigan employee, I couldn't sign a contract, so I didn't, which was stupid. But we did create the first nerve monitor through Nicolet. Someone evaluated my NIM monitor. They didn't have an NDA, so they wanted their name on it. They took the idea, and they had another company clone it.
Gotcha.
So that killed our initial sales through Nicolet, who were not happy with me because I promised them that it would work well. Eventually, the clone started proving itself to be very poor. Everybody gave up on it. I went to a little company called Zomed, X-O-M-E-D. They weren't interested in neurophysiologic monitoring. They were just doing tubes and tonsils and sinuses. I said, look, I can get you the machine on the cheap. President bought it, turned into a home run, so much so that Medtronic bought out Zomed. And it became the number one facial nerve monitor for a long time.
And you signed a contract with Zomed before you brought the machine over, correct?
With Zomed, I did.
All right.
And then when Medtronic bought them out, initially I thought it was a good thing because I knew that facial nerve monitoring was only a piece of the puzzle. Now let's monitor spine and thyroid and brain and prostate. But the Medtronic ENT division said, well, we don't do any of those things. And so I couldn't get them to move forward. But eventually the Medtronic national, international company bought out Sophomore Danek and created the NIM Spine. I said, well, that's my device. Nice. They said, oh, no, it's not. It's totally different. So I had to get into some deliberations, you know, with Medtronic. So in life, everything is a bit of a battle, and creativity is important, but just as important is resilience, because if every time someone says no, you give up, you'll never get anywhere.
Right.
And then I try to convince the spine surgeons who were just doing SEP at the time and starting to do MEP for spine surgery. I said, look, now that instrumentation is coming in, you need to start stimulating your pedicle screws. And for a decade, even though we had CAR-2 stimulators in 1982, no one was interested until I think Blair Clancy said, hey, I got an idea. Why don't we stimulate? So no one seemed to have remembered CAR-2 stimulators. But eventually, as you know, stimulation for pedicle screws, you know, became standard of care. We developed monitoring. I left University of Michigan. I got tired of the politics. Everybody said, you'll never be able to make it without the mecca of University of Michigan. But we started Michigan Ear Institute with my partners, Dennis Bozrab and Mike LaRue and Malcolm Graham and Ken McGee. And everybody said, you'll never make it. And within a few years, we were doing more volume than University of Michigan, Wayne State, and Henry Ford combined. Then all the spine surgeons started coming up to us saying, hey, we know you're doing facial monitoring. Why don't you take over spine monitoring? We're trying to find different companies doing it, and everyone's having trouble finding techs and finding machines. So we became accidental entrepreneurs. You know, I had one of the busiest practices in the world, and I started a company called American Neural Monitoring, A&M.
I remember that.
And then all of a sudden we had to try to train people in spine and in brain. And it was like, how do we do this? So it was a real challenge. But we grew A&M. And then my friend H.B. Calder and Gene Balzer ended up merging for Biotronic. So as you know, in addition to having one of the largest surgical practices in the country, developing inventions, writing 200 papers in my spare time, I started the nerve monitoring company. And then I said, you know what? There is basically nerve monitoring malpractice. We don't have a good way to train techs and test them. Remote monitoring was just started. Well, you know, maybe you're a great neurologist in multiple sclerosis, but that doesn't help you in monitoring spine.
Right.
So there was a lot of real problems that many people weren't recognizing, and I wasn't happy with it. So in my spare time, I started the first society in the world on monitoring, the American Society of Neurophysiologic Monitoring. And, you know, internet was just starting then. It was really hard finding people. But Gene Balzer was one of the first people I found, and he was a superstar. He really helped put AS&M together, and I've intermittently worked with Gene over the decades, and I can't recommend him or anyone else more highly.
And Gene, he has quite the resume himself. So
Gene's, he does. And so then for a while, I cut back my surgical practice, and I became chief medical officer at Biotronic. And the short story is that Biotronic got bought out by NuVasive. Moving on here, so we started the American Society of Neurophysiologic Monitoring, and then some of the people spun off the DABNM to be able to certify interpretation. The American Academy of Neurology got involved. Mark Neuer was a major head there, but we had significant differences. And I understand the benefit of having board-certified neurologists, but I also didn't believe that a multiple sclerosis doctor with no understanding of intraoperative neurophysiology and the specifics of pedicle screw or brainstem gliomas, etc., immediately had the ability and the competence to do remote monitoring.
Right. Especially
remote monitoring. was being done at home. And early on, James, as you recall, the connectivity wasn't great.
Yep.
And so how did most neurologists monitoring for home or their office, how did they know what was happening in the operating room? And the answer is?
They didn't.
Yep. Hopefully, if they had a good tech, the tech would have a text. We are now opening. Using Bovi. Spreading. Pedicle screw. These are good things. But is it the same as being there? No. Is it the same as going in and taking a half a year and training in intraoperative neurophysiologic monitoring? So I have been the biggest go-getter and promoter of neuromonitoring that I can think of anyone in the world. But the times that I would lecture around the world to say, as good as we are, we've got a long way to go. And it's amazing how little feedback I have. And so that has been an area of disappointment for me.
Gotcha. So I want to dig into some of the things that you just talked about with reference to remote monitoring, what good monitoring is, some of those questions. But before we do, I want to ask you. So during your life, you sent me your CV. I was commenting before we started the recording. I don't think I've ever seen a 77-page CV before. It's very impressive.
Well, it's only because I sent you half of it, James.
You sent me the abbreviated version. So quality and making sure that we provide the highest level of neuromonitoring, making sure that we do things correctly. You just recently, along with several others, released a best practices in facial nerve monitoring. So talk to me about, some of the things that you've seen, even just recently, but over the years that, prompted the need for that best practices document.
Thank you for the question. There's so many different ramifications. For lecturing on the benefits of monitoring, I also lectured on the pitfalls of monitoring. The nerve monitor or any nerve monitor is never meant to just flip it on and say it's going to work. There's lots of technology. The Da Vinci robot is one such thing. Mm-hmm. You can't just say, all right, I want to buy a Da Vinci robot at St. Catherine Hospital and start using it.
Right.
You need to take courses. When endoscopic sinus surgery came out, a lot of the older sinus surgeons said, this is malpractice. You can't see well. Just cut it open and look. But endoscopic surgery had enough benefit that it did come to fruition. But you couldn't start doing endoscopic sinus surgery unless your department said you took a cadaver course.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about nerve monitoring? Don York and I used to go around the country, Nicolet centers around, Zomed centers around, and we would get lectures on how to do spine monitoring and facial nerve monitoring, auditory brainstem monitoring. And that was good. But simply not many people took those courses. And at first, monitoring was not well accepted. It was a gimmick. I can show you editorials of people saying guys like Cartouche are pushing gimmicks. Mm-hmm. We'll never replace anatomy and physiology, and they're going to cause more harm than good. And I've always said nerve monitoring is not a substitute for knowledge of anatomy, mm-hmm. but it is an adjunct. Pulse oximetry is not a substitute. It's an adjunct, but an important one.
Right.
But if you don't know how to put on the pulse oximeter correctly, it's worse than not having it. Because if you think it's giving you accurate information and it's not, it's worse than no monitoring.
Yep.
Same thing with nerve monitoring. If the facial monitor, your SEP is set up incorrectly, And the technologist or the remote neurophysiologist is saying, yep, everything's good. Baseline's quiet. Everything's good. But in reality, you didn't do best practice checks to make sure the impedance is correct, the tap test is correct, transcutaneous stimulation is correct, proximal stimulation is correct, then you haven't done your due diligence to prove that the monitor is set up. To my knowledge, there's no one in the world that has done more expert witness malpractice than me. Being a physician, my gut feeling is always to get out there and protect the doc. But I must tell you, when I review the case and they haven't done one, two, three, four, and they want me to say cartouche, let's sue the nerve device company or the technologist or the neurophysiology company, I would just say, you know what? It's possible that they didn't do the right thing, but you clearly didn't do the right thing. I can't defend you. And I'm going to help you by telling you the following. Settle now. Yeah. You're not going to win in the long run, and you're going to spend 10 times more. And at first, a lot of doctors weren't happy with me, but then I think they saw the wisdom in the long run. So the more malpractice of monitoring I saw, the more I would give lectures on poor monitoring is worse than no monitoring. It's like a soldier with a minesweeper that's broken, or he or she doesn't know how to use it, and they're moving it in the field, and it's not beeping because it's not correct. And now they're walking into a trap.
Yep.
So I think this is something that you and I've talked about in the past.
That so your statement worse monitoring or poor monitoring is worse than no monitoring at all. That is one thing that I learned from you years ago. That has stuck with me for ever since I learned that from you. It's actually something. At least on the neuromonitoring, the technologist side, I teach that to every technologist that that I have the privilege of working with and teaching, because I completely agree. If the surgeon thinks from a neuromonitoring standpoint that things are working, and you're not seeing activity or you're not seeing stimulation, they're going to be a little bit more cavalier on their resection than they may otherwise be if they had no monitoring. So
that's right. So it's been an uphill battle, and the battle is still not done. Number two, James, modality specific. Let's say you've learned how to do facial nerve monitoring. Hallelujah. Now someone says, oh, I want to do thyroid monitoring next week. The answer is no.
Well, I think thyroid monitoring is particularly can be particularly error prone if the tube's not positioned properly, if it's rotated, if it's too deep, if it's too shallow. And then if we throw a laryngeal adductor reflex monitoring on top of it, there's a whole host of additional problems. But I want to hear your thoughts on this. But I completely agree.
It's easy to be a bad leader, especially when the company is just running on its own momentum. But the best leader is going to say, what's really the right thing to do for my staff and for this company, even if share prices hurt in the short run? If a device is doing well, you can see why a company isn't going to want to take things off the market. I designed the NIM. I designed the cartouche stimulators. I recruited my friend Dick Prass, who had the Prass stimulator. Mm-hmm. Which I'm going to put out some videos, has pros and cons, because the tip is flush, and if you don't put it directly on the nerve, you may have a problem. But the thing that bothered me the most was the laryngeal nerve monitor. But I think Goldstone was one of the guys who came up with the idea of putting an electrode on the endotracheal tube. And prior to that, I would do laryngeal endoscopy and put needle electrodes in the cords or in the false vocal cords. But I immediately saw that there were some poor design issues for the laryngeal monitor. Why? the vocal cords look like a V upside down. The electrodes were here anteriorly, but most of the muscle energy is posterior, the posterior cricoid. So right off the bat, I told companies, if you're going to do laryngeal monitoring, move those electrodes. Mm-hmm. So for a number of years, false negative errors because the surgeon swears that he or she was stimulating the nerve and they didn't get a response. Next, they had problems with silicone tubes, with the balloon herniating over the Murphy eye, herniating over the end of the tube, the wire reinforcing the endotracheal tube, coming out and forming a fiber clot. I told companies around the world, look, this is an issue.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some of those pictures too.
Yeah, I wrote a number of articles, and there are some articles in anesthesia literature, CRNA. But when I first was the first to report it, because one of my partner's patients almost died because the endotracheal tube got obstructed with clot, that in February, the silicone versions of the endotracheal tubes, that there is a recall. In that True North Medtronic book, Bill George talked about all these good guys, but he also talked about the bad guys. And sometimes they're not intrinsically bad, they're just not making the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't talked about this for a couple decades. A young, incredibly bright thyroid surgeon asked to work with me on an American Academy of Otolaryngology lecture. I did the first half on facial, he did the second half on thyroid. But just before I stopped my part, I said, here is a picture of an endotracheal tube getting included, leading to near death. Be careful. And at the end of the lecture, he was outraged that I would say something negative about a product that we're using. I felt a little bad at first, and I said, but if the truth doesn't come out, people aren't going to pay attention to it. There's 100 articles on thyroid monitoring now. But some of the most prestigious are by the International Study Group on Thyroid. And I would encourage all of you to look at the first couple recommendations. And I had suggested, in addition to saying, here's how good it is, here's how you can use it most effectively, here are the ways to look out for false positives and false negatives, at no point did any of those dozens of international thyroid specialists say the risk of airway obstruction. So again, I didn't talk about this for decades. Since I may be dead in a little bit, maybe this is a good time to talk about it. Maybe I should have talked about it before. But you know what? If you want to be a good character in the community, you don't pick on every fight. You don't get into bickering with people, especially people that you respect. But if anyone's interested, go back, go to the FDA MAUDE, MAUDE, Adverse Effect website. Type in endotracheal tube monitoring, and you'll see how many injuries and false positive and false negatives have come out over the decades.
Yeah, so I did that a lot.
So in one regard, I think, you know, I probably did the right thing, just being quiet, let things work out. And another part of me towards the end of my life and career say, maybe I should have took the bullet and been even more forthright. I don't know. I don't have a perfect answer for that.
So but, do you regret not having talked about it more forcefully decades
ago? It's something that I belabor with now. And the irony is that as you and I talked about, I was on my deathbed in December. My daughter's an otolaryngologist in Austin, Texas. I said, hon, I'm done. I had a better career than I've ever thought I would have, and I'm done. Allison Cartouche says, Dad, the American Academy of Otolaryngology just sent out this note saying that the NEM 4.0 vitals are having all these problems. You got to do one more thing before you die. And I go, Jesus. So for right or wrong, I went back on chemo. I went on palliative therapy. And for the last 5 months, I've been working day in and day out to identify the problems with the nerve monitor. And it's been a real challenge, but I'm happy to say that just yesterday, the company put out a statement to go around the world that if you have a NEM Vital 4.0, there is a new software coming out that should be used. So we did accomplish a lot. I don't know that it's everything. I would strongly ask all of your viewers to go onto YouTube, Google my name, and look at some of my newest teaching videos on pitfalls in monitoring, on the new montage in monitoring, now that people have gone from 2-channel to 4-channel. You should be using orbicularis oculi, oris, mentalis. You know why mentalis? Turns out that it is one of the most sensitive ways to pick up small amplitude potentials. And it was found by my friend, Dave Hacker, who's a longtime senior engineer at Medtronic. And number four.
I know Dave very well.
Yep. And number four, we've worked together for 40 years since Nicolay. And number four is to use the 4th channel for either masseter or trapezius to act as a reference to look for artifacts.
Artifacts.
So this is something that every nerve monitoring company, university department in the world should look at, integrate, teach, and start doing yesterday. There's also more information about using transcutaneous stimulation before you ever make a stimulation, a tap test. The problem with the latest NEM Vital is they made the artifact suppression so strong, which in one regard is good, but they also recommended people use not just a PRAS probe, but a PRAS recording needle, which is 50 to 80% insulated. Yep. So the needle is your antenna. The more you cloak it in rubber, the less it can record.
Mm-hmm.
So the biggest complaint is that the surgeons are saying, I've been using the NIMP for 40 years. There's something wrong now. False negative errors. I stimulate. I know I'm on the nerve, and I'm not getting a response. Your strong artifact software suppression is dampening it. Your insulated needles are dampening it. And now you're dampening artifact, but guess what? You're dampening signal.
Yep.
So it's been a challenge. Fortunately, I've been working with some very good people at Medtronic. I wish we could move faster. They always say, Cartouche, you don't understand. You know, with those processes, we have to go through regulatory and legal. I understand that. But I've also said, there's a fire in the kitchen now. Until we fix this, people may get injured. We need to go beyond so-and-so. And when companies say, like Boeing, well, the FAA says we're doing the right thing. We checked off saying we're following quality. But guess what? The FAA never went in. All they did is they said, oh, Boeing checked off these 3 checkboxes. Okay.
So the problem was
Boeing didn't do what they checked off. And not until they grilled the head of the Federal Aviation FAA, they go, they weren't doing it. So now FAA people are in Boeing to see what they're really doing.
Yeah.
I say in a similar way, the FDA allows medical devices to get by for years because they say, oh, well, the company said that they made a correction. Go back to the FDA website. Look to see how many glitches, how many times they made a little tweak, and they said, oh, it's okay. But then something happened 6 months later. It's astonishing. So I think if our governmental agencies not doing their jobs They are also culpable for allowing the companies to get away with these things. Boeing proves it. Need to learn from Boeing and saying, all right, just because we've been able to tell the FDA that we're okay, are we really okay? Is this what we want for our kids?
Yeah.
So again, James, like you and I talked about before, I didn't want this to be all doom and gloom, but I really felt it was time for me to not just be a cheerleader for monitoring, but to also reveal some of the pitfalls that have lasted far too long.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I appreciate you doing that. So from a technologist and from a neurophysiologist standpoint, I know we've talked a little bit about some of the technology and the device issues, but what on the, you know, the personnel side of things do you see that needs to be improved or changed to increase the quality of the neuromonitoring that we're providing?
Well, keep me up to speed. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, there's very good ABRET testing for technologists mm-hmm. now. I think most technologists have a significant period of time. I don't know if it's established anywhere. I would also say that if you're training a technologist and he or she is great at facial monitoring, it doesn't mean that they're great at glioblastomas. Mm-hmm. Procedure specific. Number two, the remote monitoring neurologist. DABNM, to test the capabilities of the interpreting neurologist or neurophysiologist, has been around for years, but, quote, it hasn't caught on. Why not? How is it that our world and society says, well, we'll make the techs go through 6 months and take a test, but, you know, if you say that you're a neurophysiologist, neurologist, you can do just what you say you think you can do. So tell me, maybe I'm behind on it. Am I wrong? Has that changed?
DABNM is still not standard, I don't think, for a lot of neurologists. I mean, I think, to my knowledge, there are more neurologists that are not DABNM than there are
way
that
more,
have sat for the
mistaken.
Exam.
Yeah. Correct?
Yes.
And is there any other group or society that tests and certifies abilities at that level?
Not to my knowledge.
And it needs to be corrected.
How do you see navigating that those waters to you know, to push MDs to, you know, up their game, so to speak, and to, you know, get a little bit more training, make sure they know what they're doing, and sit for an exam like the DABNM.
People out there know that there's a huge difference in talent, and they let it continue. They let it continue when they know the company down the street is doing poorly, but they also let it happen in their own company. Is it because they're terrible and unethical? Not necessarily. I think there's the pressure of a business, and this comes back to the true north here. So let's say, James, you start a new company in Alaska or Alabama, and now you're having trouble finding enough people, and now the hospital says, look, you committed to do this. We need to get this case done.
Mm-hmm.
There's pressure on you. So now what do you do?
Oh.
And you, I cancel every case. The hospital is going to say, well, you lost the gig.
Yep.
So I think people like you and Gene Balzer and the presidents of the ASNM and ISIN, even though it's an international, you need to start saying, listen to what Cartouche is saying. Let's band together and put a working committee together to saying we need to fix this. And unless someone's got the cojones to do this, you will continue to harm people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I hear you.
James, I hope you and the people listening to this can go beyond just a simple podcast and start broadcasting this and say, Cartouche has laid down the sword. He's identified a problem that we have ignored for decades. Who among you will take this on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think obviously there is very high quality neuromonitoring and very high quality training, but at the same point or at the same time, there is some very shoddy stuff being done out there right now. So this brings me to, I think you and others years ago, back in 1989, if I recall, saw a need to improve the field of neuromonitoring. And as a part of that, to kind of give neuromonitoring, I think, a little bit more of a singular voice by establishing the American Society of Neurophysiologic Monitoring. And you were the inaugural president of ASNM. So talk about that. Talk about how ASNM came to be. You know, what you saw that was the genesis for, you know, putting together ASNM, starting that. And then what was it like starting, you know, a society that now has, you know, well over 1,000 members, you know, annually renewing their membership?
Yeah, I'm so grateful to see that. But it was a difficult birth. And again, this was early on when the internet was first getting started. And so here I was in my office trying to say, well, how do I find leaders in nerve monitoring? It wasn't easy. So I did a lot of work and I found some very good people. And then, of course, people had different feelings. Some people worked in academic settings. Some people worked in a corporate setting and they had different priorities.
Mm-hmm.
Some people worked with neurologists remote monitoring. Some didn't. Mark Neuer was amazing in the work he did, but he was totally self-focused on how it affects the American Academy of Neurology. And I guess, well, you know, if he's a spokesperson, I could appreciate that. He met with the Medicare reimbursement team and said, surgeons shouldn't be reimbursed. They're not trained in monitoring. They're too busy doing surgery. And so he killed reimbursement for surgeons.
Okay.
I totally agree. A surgeon doesn't have the ability to do multimodality complex monitoring of SEP, MEP, EMG, carotids. They can't. They need a team.
Mm-hmm.
Facial nerve monitoring is different. And the way it started, it was the surgeon and the monitor. Sometimes we had a nurse or a tech or a resident plug in the electrodes and turn up the volume. If they were educated, the experience was phenomenal. Here's why. Because if I'm taking out an acoustic neuroma, I've got my suction here and I got my Cartouche stimulator here, and I get a beep. I know that beep is correlated mm-hmm. in real time to what I hear. If I stretch it with my suction, I know I've stretched it. But even if you're a good technologist, you're not completely focused on the oscilloscope every second. And even if you are, then it keeps you from looking up at the video monitor, what the surgeon's doing.
Mm-hmm. If you even have a video monitor.
If you have a video monitor. And Lord knows what's happening to the neurologist at his home in Poughkeepsie. Do you know what a Ring doorbell camera is?
I do. I have one.
So do I. My Ring doorbell will give me real-time video, real-time audio, and a speaker 100 times a day. No one orders more from Amazon than my wife. If my Ring camera doesn't go off, Jeff Bezos calls and says, I'm sorry, Mrs. Cartouche, is there a problem? So you tell me, camera, audio, speaker on my doorbell. We can't put that on the surgeon's light or helmet. I've talked about this for years. Wrong. That's one. Numero duo dos. Now, let's say the neurophysiologist in the other room or in the other state, great. Now they can see that Cartouche is doing that. He hears a beep. He looks up. He sees he's got the suction here. He can hear my conversation saying, all right, that was just a traction. There's this two-way feedback. And all of a sudden, the neurologist, the technologist, everybody has got 100 times more useful information to help the patient. Without it, you're blind and you're deaf. It's not right.
I completely agree on that one. We have all of the technology that we need in order to be able to do that. I mean, Teams, we have Zoom, we have 100 different platforms that we could be utilizing to have two-way communication between the technologist and the neurologist, but also between the surgeon and the neurologist. I mean, we have, you know, we have teleneurology at this point. I mean, it really should be implemented in our field. I think you will be excited to know that I think there are companies, the one that I work with, NMA, is one of those that is rapidly implementing that because I think that it is
any company
needed.
That's interested, yeah. Have to call me. But I would just say, you know, there's 10 million podcasts out there. And I think you and I chose today to talk about not just the routine, easy things. We intentionally chose to talk about some controversial things. I don't know how to do it, James, because I'm not the podcaster. But if you've got a way to get out there and burst out this podcast to say, hey, alert, just like the American Academy of Otolaryngology sent an alert to 40,000 surgeons in December, I think you and your comrades and friends need to get out there and say, hey, this is not your routine podcast. This is a call to action. And every month we wait, we increase the chance of patient injury. Who's going to come on board and make a difference?
Yeah, I completely agree.
And I'll tell you, the last thing on my agenda too is, remember, I think that surgeons got screwed by the neurology's academy saying, oh, they shouldn't even be doing it. They shouldn't be reimbursed. And so some surgeons that were routinely using the NIM, et cetera, they said, oh, well, we never get reimbursed. Well, forget it. We might as well let the service or the hospital's department do it. Well, guess what? That made the surgeons even stupider, because it was like, well, all right, now I don't care about putting in the electrodes. And what do I know about insulated or non-insulated press electrodes? Should I use a Cartouche stimulator? Should I use a ball tip probe for Yingling? What is the correct impedance? Should I do a tap test? So regrettably, this has led to even worse information from the surgeons. For 15 years, I went to the American Academy of Otolaryngology and said, please, we need a curriculum for nerve monitoring. We need testing. It should be part of the ACGME training. I was repeatedly turned down. Well, we don't know if we really need it. And if we look into this, we've got to check with the Academy and with the Otologic Society and the Neurologic Society. And Cartouche, you know, you've been involved in the industry so long, maybe you're not the one to do this. I said, fine. Find somebody who else is. Regrettably, there's no one that I can tell that has had 40 years experience on nerve monitoring, development, teaching, corporations, entrepreneurial, to be able to do this. And as one of the famous otologists from Los Angeles recently posted He said one of the reasons that the nerve monitor has not been functioning well is for the first time they did not have an otologist, like Cartouche, work on the development of the new monitor. Since 1977, I worked with Dave Hacker, an outstanding engineer at Nicolet and Zomit and Medtronic, and we never let out a new iteration until we both agreed that it was correct from engineering, neurophysiology, mm-hmm. and surgery. When I stepped away from the company, you know who replaced me?
No one.
Nada. They said, well, you know, we talk with people now and then. That's not the same. So thank goodness the current Medtronic team took the bull by the horns, working with me for the last half year. We've identified numerous issues. We found numerous ways to fix it. It's not 100%, but it's going to be a lot better. But I'll bring it back to the start of our conversation. You want a good engineering product. You better make sure that engineers and surgeons and clinicians and physiologists are involved in this device, not just accountants. Same thing that Elon Musk said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so changing gears just a little bit. So I think while we were recording, we brought up the fact that you have a creative side. You have taught yourself, I think, to learn how to or to, how to play the guitar. I think you've published some songs. I think you've been signed. So talk about the creative side of Dr. Cartouche.
Yeah, I think it's a bit similar. You know, why do you invent songs? Why do you invent devices? Why do you persist when people knock you down? So again, not to get into it too much, but I saw the Beatles when I was 12 years old. I said, this is phenomenal. I learned how to play guitar. I started a band. I tried to differentiate the band and set the drums on fire. Got offered a recording contract from Decca Records. They want us to wear costumes and do dance moves. As 17-year-olds, we refused. And so we refused, and Decca Records found a guy named David Jones in London who agreed. He changed his name to David Bowie, and he took the contract.
So we could have had David Cartouche, but we got David Bowie, and I think it's a good thing because we got Jack Cartouche, who has spent, you know, a career, some would say a lifetime, you know, focusing on facial nerve monitoring, thyroid monitoring, and trying to improve how we do things, making things safer for patients, hopefully providing better outcomes. Obviously, as we've talked about, there's a long way to go. So with all of that, you know, what... When we're talking about you in 15 years from now, what do you want your legacy to be?
That he was tall, dark, and handsome. That he
next
was, he was almost a rock star, and that he developed some devices that have helped people over the decades.
How many people do you think your devices have helped?
What do you think, James? I mean, you know, people have asked me that before. So remember, if you take not just the NIM, but every spinoff of the NIM, and remember, you know, all the devices between the XL Techs, you know, remember the NIM spine was just a spinoff mm-hmm. of my NIM. And between all my friends at, you know, Cadwell and Inomed and Neurovision, I can't remember all their names. You know, we all sort of spun off of each other and we approach things in slightly different ways. So we've all tried to reduce patient harm and improve patient safety. I think it will continue. I think the entire concept of monitoring nerves and brain and neurologic function will continue to evolve as the decades go by. that people will eventually look back at some of these things that we've looked at over the last 40 years. And remember, I was not the first person to do facial nerve stimulation. I found an article in Germany in 1897 in which a neurosurgeon tried to stimulate. And of course, they couldn't monitor, so they had the nurse look under the drapes and see if the drapes quit. At the House Ear Institute, the nurse often put a hand on the face, and if the drill injured the nerve, it would twitch, and the nurse would say, "Oh my God, stop." Unfortunately, at that time, the nerve was already trashed. But so there were precursors. But there were precursors to VCR and Betamax. And sometimes the best wins, sometimes it doesn't. Betamax was better, but VCR won the VCR wins. And so there's lots of different aspects in business. The Pras Pro Pras was my friend, but I always said, "Dick, if you insulate everything to the end, you're going to have problems. If you angle a little bit, you're going to have false negatives." And now that some of the monitors are having false negatives because of bad electrodes, etc., it's even worse. So if you use a flush tip, use it when you're soaked in spinal fluid. If you're in a dry environment, like the temporal bone, not the CPA, if you're in the parotid, if you're in the thyroid, there's no reason to use a flush tip. You can use a ball tip. You can use a standard monopolar. You can use a bipolar. And if you angle it, you won't get a
You're still going to
false negative
stimulate.
error. But Pras, who's my friend, and he did very well, so he retired early from patenting it. But because it was a trade name, companies ended up pushing it. "Well, use a Pras, use a Pras, use a Pras." Use the right tool for the right job. Right job is if you're in spinal fluid, use a flush tip, even though you have to be careful about angulation error. But as you've probably seen in my cases, James, I use a suction in my left hand. If there's only a small amount of spinal fluid, I've got my stimulator, and I'll show videos on this later. When the respirator is breathing in and out, the spinal fluid comes up. I suck it out. Now it's dry. Now I use my stimulator. So even in the brain, you don't have to use a Pras. Pras makes no more royalties from it. You're not going to hurt Dick. Dick Pras is his name. And whether Dick ever really promoted the recording needles being insulated, I don't know. But the first thing you need to tell your company and get this out as a memo is immediately make sure that your needle recorders are non-insulated. There's one reason to use insulated recording needles. And that is if I'm trying to do deep muscles in my arm and I'm trying to get past the superficial muscles and measure deep, or in my leg or vastus lateralis or gastroc, I want insulation so I'm not monitoring from the superficial muscle, but I'm monitoring from the deep. Well, that's a different story when your muscles are 3 or 4 or 5 centimeters in depth. When you're monitoring the facial nerve here, the average diameter is 2 millimeters. So it's very easy to go through it or be a little superficial to it.
And then not even be recording from it with insulating
Exactly.
needles.
So now you've cloaked it, so it's not a good antenna. Now you're through it, and the part that's insulated is touching the muscle, but the uninsulated part is through it. Double jeopardy. So an alert that people need to know about. We are talking things that are of extreme importance that will make a difference in your nerve monitoring practice tomorrow. And every day that your companies, other academic institutions delay using the new montage, installing the new software, using non-insulated electrodes, you increase the chance of error.
These are very important topics that we've talked about. So another very important thing that I learned from you, I heard you say years ago, and I think that it rings true, is, and you said it with relation to a surgeon, but I use this with relation to, you know, neurophysiologists and with technologists. When I'm teaching, you know, I will use this. I give you credit, but I've stolen it from you. You know, you once said the difference between a good surgeon, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the exact quote, but the difference between a good surgeon and an excellent surgeon is that the excellent surgeon has not only prepared for the surgery, but all of the bad outcomes that could happen, and they have a plan for how to deal with those potential issues. So I think that is worth remembering and taking to heart. I think it's made me a better technologist because, you know, I not only anticipate what, you know, I should expect to see during this surgery, but I anticipate the different things that could go wrong with the neuromonitoring, the changes that we could see related to surgery, related to, you know, other issues, factors that the patient, you know, may be experiencing, and how we're going to respond to those. Because not only do you need to be able to respond to them, you have to be able to communicate that. And sometimes people don't want to hear that message, especially if it may not have anything directly to do with what they're doing, you know, in the surgical field at the time. I mean, you know, I've seen patients stroke before that has nothing to do with what, you know, is happening in surgery, but we still have to be able to communicate that. But so, well, thank you.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, think about most people's education. They'll come on in and they'll watch a mastoidectomy and everything seems to go well. And the surgeon stimulates and the nerve responds and the kid wakes up with a normal face. And it's go, oh, great. But you have to think, well, what are the 12 things that could have gone wrong? Mm-hmm. Was it wrong setup? Was it inadequate stimulus intensity? Was it the electrodes? Because remember, if every surgery turned into a disaster, we wouldn't be doing surgery. So the mm-hmm. fact that the majority of surgeries go well, it does mean that whether it is a surgeon, a tech, neurophysiologist, neurologist, if you're coming in during your training, statistically, chances are, during that acoustic neuroma, during that pedicle screw, during that glioblastoma, chances are things are going to go pretty well. But you learn a lot more when things go bad. Mm-hmm. And now you see, all right, now we're not getting a response when we should. Is it a false negative? Is it a true negative? Now, what are the 12 things we need to do to troubleshoot? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So even on cases that seem to go well, I think a teacher like you needs to say, all right, well, you know, this case went great. Nice, simple pedicle screw. We were done in a short period of time. But what happens if we didn't get a stimulation at 15 milliamps. We got one at 3 milliamps. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Did you breach it? Do you put a new screw in? Do you come at a different angle? Even if you're the tech, you need to understand your neurophysiologic information has just given some extraordinarily important information mm-hmm. to everybody in the room. Now, hopefully you got a good surgeon. And he or she says, all right, this is happening. I'm going to reroute my drill. Or I'm just going to use a feeler. All these different types of things. But now, whoever you're teaching needs to say, okay, here's six different things I've learned that could be used now to find out, is this a true positive, a false positive, a true mm-hmm. negative? And how do we differentiate between them? So, yeah. Beautiful, easy cases, hallelujah. You're not going to learn as much as in the bad cases yep. or in the ones in which you, as the teacher, James, says, let's say it didn't go this well. Now you tell me the three things we could have done if so-and-so happened.
Yep. interested in your thoughts on artificial intelligence is going to bring to the field. I'm curious as to where you think things are headed with some of the new technologies and things that are coming out.
What I have tried to do with my nerve monitors is to start to build in elementary AI. So for example, let's say you're using one of my monitors. You haven't made an incision. You plugged in the electrodes. You turn on the machine. What's the first thing that usually happens when a machine boots up? What does it test?
It's going to make sure the software is functional. It's going to verify that. And then, the first thing that we're going to do usually is test impedances, right?
Exactly. Thank you, James. So that needs to be tested. I'll give you one example. What is the normal level of impedance that you would expect for the machine to say passed? What should the impedance level be?
Well, based on the ACNS guidelines, I would say that it should be less than 5,000 ohms.
So, good man. You're passing beautifully. You won't have to do any editing. So you're right. So 40 years ago, we decided that less than 5K kilohms is the amount. But guess what? You use a brass insulated needle, the resistance goes up to 25 kilo-ohms.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? It doesn't pass. Or the engineers say, well, we do like brass needle electrodes, and they're proprietary, and we're selling a bunch. So we'll change the impedance check to say if the impedance check is less than 25 ohms, it passes. Is that a good decision or not? But that is a decision that had recently been made a year or two ago for some machines. Hmm. And people need to look at my YouTube videos on best practices in monitoring. It took me a decade to be able to get it published. Well, you know, do we really want to have standard of care? I mean, yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. It took you would think that that wouldn't be a hard thing to come to an agreement on.
It's insanity. It's ego. But it took me, and thank God for all my co-authors. And again, we'll put these on the screen. But I
definitely
said, check
we'll
impedance. Do a tap test. You know what a tap test is? You tap on the electrodes. Mm-hmm. Well, holy cow. The latest software from one of the monitors said, oh, our artifact suppression with the insulated electrodes is so good that the tap test doesn't work anymore. So don't do a tap test. Really? So one of the most basic tests that takes 2 seconds to do, you're being told don't do it? So that would be changed. Next, have you seen my transcutaneous simulation? But it works better than anything else. So you put the patient asleep. You take a non-sterile stimulator. Patient's asleep. Electrodes are in. Boot up the machine. Impedance is good. Put the stimulator on 5 and slowly turn it up to 6, 7, and all of a sudden, beep, 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 beep. That immediately tells you, one, the stimulator is working because it's coming from the monitor.
Yep.
So it works better than a train of 4, which is a portable battery unit that doesn't tell you anything about stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
So transcutaneous stimulation works better than anything.
Yeah, I do that.
Number two, it then goes to the needle electrodes. That goes to the machine. Now you know the needles are good. Now you know that the volume is set correctly. I've had malpractice cases in which the monitor was set up correctly, but the volume was on 0.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing is that by doing this, you know there's no neuromuscular blockade.
Yep.
TCS. There's a whole video on it. It only takes 3.7 minutes to watch. Everybody ought to watch it and start doing it tomorrow. I'm going to show you how we can now stimulate transcutaneously 5 milliamps through the skin to check the facial nerve electrodes are functioning and there's no muscle relaxing.
We'll make sure to link to it.
I hope I'm not being overly aggressive, but I'm doing so just because I'm fed up with the lack of compliance for standard best practices. And there's got to be some leaders like you and Jean Balzer and others in the world, Sadat, to say, enough.
Yep.
It's time to make the change.
I completely agree. Okay, so before I ask you the very last question, I do want to just congratulate you, because I think just recently you were informed that a couple of your inventions are actually going to be admitted and on display at the Smithsonian, right?
Yes.
For everyone to see.
Thank you,
James. Nice.
So
well, congratulations.
The nerve monitor
there.
And the cartoon stimulators will work their way to the Smithsonian. So something that we're happy about.
Nice. I'll look for those the next time I'm there.
That's great.
Okay. Very last question. So parting thoughts for the NeuroPod community. Anything that you didn't get a chance to bring up or talk about that you want to make sure you leave with the community?
Well, you know, I think we covered it well. And James, a tribute to you. And then I do hope that some of the people who listen to this do not look at me as Shakespeare, angry young man, just yelling into the night, but someone who's saying, look, this emotion comes from decades of trying to do the right thing, succeeding in some, but not in others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think trying to improve patient care and shouting that from the rooftop is a great thing. So, well, Dr. Cartouche, thank you for taking your time to speak with me and to enlighten the listeners on some of the things that we need to, I think, improve on as we move forward in neuromonitoring and as we move forward in surgery. Thank you very much, and we wish you all the best.
James Watt, it's been a pleasure knowing you over the years. Thank you for including me. All the best to you.
Thank you. Pleasure's mine.
NeuroPod content is intended for personal use and general information purposes only. NeuroPod cannot guarantee the accuracy of any statements made by guests or the sufficiency of the information. The opinions and views expressed by guests do not necessarily reflect or represent those of the hosts or producers. Such views are opinions of the guests and should not be used to inform appropriate patient care or for legal purposes. If you have specific medical concerns or questions, you should contact your healthcare provider. It is the listener's responsibility to confirm the accuracy of opinions and views before putting them into practice. NeuroPod disclaims any and all liability for injury or other damages for all claims which may result from the use of the information presented.